Okay, good. So I've been asked to give a kind of a very basic tutorial on quantum thermodynamics. So maybe just to get an idea of where people are at, how many people already kind of know about Landau erasure and Maxwell Diemond? Okay, and how many people majorization? How many people familiar with major? Okay. So maybe 2/3 of the people. So I'll maybe go a bit quicker through the kind of the basics. So what I thought I would, the way I would arrange it is I would start off with like a toy theory of thermodynamics to just build up people's intuition. So a toy theory which connects information theory to thermodynamics. And effectively the idea is that we can think of thermodynamics as a kind of information theory and as a special case of what we call resource theories. So if people were here for my tutorial on entanglement theory, there's a whole bunch of areas of physics which we now can regard as what we call resource theories or they're kind of an information theory where, and those include entanglement theory and includes thermodynamics. And it's a kind of a general way of quantifying the amount of resources you need in a particular theory. And I guess, in some sense, the history of thermodynamics was very similar to the history of quantum information theory, where people were asking, you know, what are the resources required to perform a particular task? So we want to build a heat engine and we're interested in the resources required for this heat engine and when are we optimal, when are we not optimal. Likewise with quantum information theory and quantum computation, we wanted, they both kind of come from the engineering side of physics. So they're engineering problems and we learn that there's an intimate connection between kind of engineering and physics in some funny way. So I'll start with kind of that, then I'll kind of then I will talk about thermodynamics as a resource theory. So I'll talk about how we can think of it like this. And lastly, we'll see how time goes. I'll talk about fluctuation relations. So I think that some of the, when people say quantum thermodynamics, they can mean a number of different things. Sometimes they just mean finite-sized systems, and there's nothing quantum about them. So it's just the fact that we're not taking the thermodynamic limit. So that's one of the things. We have finite-sized systems. We're not taking the thermodynamic limit. The other hallmark of quantum thermodynamics is that we have a quantum system, so we may be interested in the truly quantum aspects that make it different to classical thermodynamics. And then the other thing is that often the fluctuations in our systems are much larger than the average quantities that we're usually interested in thermodynamics. So in thermodynamics, we usually talk about the average work, the average entropy, or entropy is an average quantity in some sense. But here, for small finite-sized systems, the fluctuations can be much larger. So I thought I would divide it into these three topics. So talk about fluctuations last. The resource theory approach is, well, we'll get into that, but that was effectively the plan of the talk. There's quite a few experts in quantum thermodynamics here, so people, Nicole, Fernando, Wojtek, and various other people, so I guess there can be more, people should feel free to kind of ask questions and chime in and that sort of thing. Okay. Good. So let me give the toy theory first. And it's just to show what I want to show is the connection between thermodynamics information theory and polarization is important. And I'll explain what that is. So let's start with this kind of toy. We call it thermodynamics for children. And it's a toy theory of thermodynamics. What we imagine is we have what we call a Zillard box. So it's a box with two partitions, a left one and a right one. And it's immersed in a thermal bath. And the first thing we, at least two-thirds of you already know, is that information is work, or you know, knowledge is power, or whatever you want to slogan you want to use. But effectively, that we can, from information, we can convert that into work. So, if I have a partition, I have a box, and there's two partitions, and I happen to know the molecule. There's one. Let's imagine there's one molecule in this box, and I happen to know it's on the left-hand side. Then I can extract one bit of work from this box simply by putting a piston on one side and letting the molecule, letting this molecule bounce around and push out this partition. And when it does that, the weight will raise, and I will have extracted one unit of work, kT log two bits of work, from this system. So we'll call this the distillable work, and from this system it's kT log two.
On average over the thermal distributions?
Well, we'll talk about that, but in this case, this is deterministic, right? So I know the molecules here, so I will...
But you don't know what its actual velocity is, for instance.
Well, I guess I'm just interested in how much the weight gets lifted. So in some sense, yeah, it will undergo these fluctuations, but I mean, it's actually a little bit unclear what happens with these systems. So people have done numerical simulations, and you can ask, you know, where is this piston going to wind up if I just let it equilibrate? And it's not such a simple thing, because of course it's not going to go to the very end. It'll kind of, and you could, but...
And more generally, it seems to me the answer to this should depend on the microdynamics that we assume. I need to know something about that.
Well, you need to know that it's going to equilibrate, that this thing is in that this molecule...
What is the definition of equilibration?
Sorry?
What is the definition of equilibration?
I think in this case, I just need to know what the velocity distribution of this thing. So, I just need to know that it's... I mean, if I'm asking about, you know, whether it's actually T, what the value is here, you know, if it's actually kT log 2, or whether I'm asking about, I guess we're often more interested in this log 2, in which case that I just need that I don't need to know very much, because I just need that it will eventually kind of traverse the phase space and kind of fill the phase space of this box.
You're using classical language.
Right. So I think for the first part of this talk, when I talk about majorization, it'll be a very classical. We'll be talking about a very classical notion, and I'll get into the more quantum aspects. So as I mentioned, this quantum thermodynamics has various aspects to it, and some notions are we just want to understand finite size systems, and some things we want to understand the fully quantum things. But I mean, I guess in terms of understanding thermalization, you of course know that there's a huge there's a huge body of work in terms of understanding thermalization, and I guess here I don't need to think. I don't want to worry too much about whether we mean, you know, we know that things never really thermalize, things typically don't thermalize. We can talk about thermalization in terms of a particular set of observables, or as you've kind of introduced this eigenstate thermalization, or there's a number of notions we could use. And I don't want to get bogged down. That is, I think, a whole separate. You could have a series of lectures on that, and I don't know that. I want to get into that. Wojtek looks like he wants to say something.
No.
Okay.
I don't.
Okay.
The only thing that I think could sort of put things somewhat to rest is that you assume that this thing happens infinitely slowly.
Sure.
The lifting, which might mean adjusting the weight that hangs there so that the pressure is such that PV equals KT equals is satisfied throughout. Right, and that will, I think, even out fluctuations and so on. Right, but I mean,
Mark doesn't look happy, but I'm interested in this discussion, and I would like to have it. So, but maybe we can have it afterwards, or good. So. So this is kT log 2 bits of work you can get out of this thing from knowing where it is, assuming that it will thermalize. And now I want to ask So this is, I guess, from the very beginning, this was kind of the connection between information theory and thermodynamics. You had all kinds of questions of Maxwell's demon, like what happens if I don't know? So I can imagine if I, at the end of this process, I won't know where the molecule is. I can now imagine measuring to find out where this molecule is in order to extract KT log two bits of work again. And then we had this whole story of Charlie Bennett, who kind of says, well, now this demon's memory, we need to consider that to be a system and account for the erasure of the demon's memory. So this is the whole, I think, where the story starts in terms of connecting information theory and thermodynamics. Let me now ask a question about, and there's a number of questions you could ask about the fluctuations. So for example, if I want to do the reverse process, it'll cost me KT log two bits of work to erase this bit. So we can think of this like a bit left and right. And if I start off with the, if I start off where initially I don't know where the molecule is, so it's a piece, I can think of it like a piece of magnetic tape, which is where I don't know what the value of the bit is. If I want to reset this bit to the zero state, then that will cost me KT log two bits of work. I've got to sit here and push in my piston until I know for sure that the molecule is on the left-hand side, and that is the cost of bit erasure. Right. Now, let me just ask a question about bit erasure, which maybe some of you, I know some of you have thought about, which is, you know, we know that in Landauer's erasure, it costs KT log two bits of work. What do we mean by that? Do we mean KT log two bits of work on average? Can we sometimes gain work when we, if we are willing to put in, if you're willing to put in more work, can we sometimes gain work in this process? How many think that it's actually KT log two bits of work on average, and that there's fluctuations around that? I mean, if we do this many times, we will.
If you do it infinitely slowly.
If you do it infinitely slowly.
Slowly on average.
Yes. Right. And it turns out that actually you can never, that you only ever achieve KT log two bits of work on average when there's no, so people often would say this is an average and that there are fluctuations around that, around this value. But actually what happens is you only are able to achieve KT log two bits of work on average when there's no fluctuations whatsoever. So that's a very idealized case. Usually there will be fluctuations and you will not be able to achieve that. So that's the typical case. And in fact, there's always a small probability that you will fail to erase this bit. There's a kind of a tiny exponentially vanishing probability that you fail to do this, which is a bit like maybe has the flavor of a third law in some sense. You can never properly reach absolute zero. You can never properly erase this bit. In the failure probability, so if I allow some failure probability, then the amount of work you have to put in will be, so the exponential amount of work you're willing to put in. So if you're willing to put in an infinitely large amount of work some of the time, then you will be able to erase with, good. Okay, so now let me ask about, imagine I have three partitions, or let me start with, let's take three partitions. And so I want to get in, I'm going to start getting into, so Alex had asked about kind of this non-IAD information theory, and so I want to get into that a little bit with these examples. So imagine that I have three molecules, three partitions, and the molecule's in one of them, and I know what the probability of the molecule being in the various partitions, and I want to know when can I go from some, and so I have a distribution, this is just a classical distribution of the probability of it being in one of these partitions, let's call it S. And I want to know when can I go from a configuration with some probability distribution like this to another probability distribution. So let's draw these big. I'll draw these with the relative size of the probability distribution. And I want to know when can I go from one configuration to another. So let's call this Q of S prime. And that I want the rules of the game, so this is a toy version of thermodynamics. The rules of the game here is I'm allowed to put in partitions and take them out, and that's it. That's all I'm allowed to do. Right? I can remove the partition for some amount of time and put it back. And I want to know, when can I go from this box with this probability distribution to this box with this other probability distribution? Right. And the answer was, in some sense, provided by Hardy, Littlewood, and Pollier way back, where they considered a bunch of processes which are sometimes called Robin Hood processes. And the Robin Hood processes are the following. I'm allowed to rob from the rich and give to the poor. That's the kind of the box theory we're dealing with. And what is that, what I mean by that is, here are the probability distributions. So imagine that in the first box is the largest probability, you know, the molecule will be in here with the largest probability, then in the second box, then in the third box. And what configurations can I get to from this? Well, what I can do is I can rob from the rich and give to the poor, meaning I'm allowed to remove a partition, wait some time, and then put it back. And when I do that, what will happen is the box with the largest probability, that probability will go down because the molecule will drift and this probability will increase. So that's what can happen. Yeah?
So your picture implies that you can only connect, say, partition one with partition two, but not directly with three.
Right, so all I'm allowed to do here is remove partitions and do that. I think if I'm allowed to do the full one, it would give you the same thing. So I mean, I could, if I want to, I'm allowed to. Let's be allowed to rearrange the ordering of the boxes. So if I want to make any configuration, then the thing I should do is I should reorder the boxes to put the one with the largest probability on the left, and then right, and then have the boxes with next largest probability, et cetera, et cetera. So I should order them from largest probability to smallest probability, and then I'll be able to do a Robin Hood process and get another configuration. Is that clear to everyone?
Can you remove two at once at the top and then just
have two partitions here, you mean?
Right.
Yeah. But that won't, so that won't be very, I mean, all that will do is just, it's equivalent to me doing one and then doing the other one. It doesn't really help me to do them both at the same time, unless I'm concerned about the timing. So these are called, the Robin Hood processes are called T-transforms. And what's been shown, what Hardy, Littlewood, and Pollier showed, is that you could write any permutation, any mixture of permutations, as a bunch of these T-transforms, meaning I could write any mixture of permutations of these probabilities in terms of just taking out a partition for some time and putting it back and doing them one at a time. I guess it's called Birkhoff's theorem as well, right? This is the kind of the name for it. Good, so this is just majorization. This is called majorization, and what we require in order to go from this probability distribution to this probability distribution is the following: that the if I were to sum the k largest eigenvalues or probabilities, so S equals, so if I've ordered them from largest to smallest, that's what this little down arrow means, and so from S equals 1 to k, I require that this is larger than, for all k, so if this is true, then we say that this probability distribution majorizes, so p majorizes q. So it's an ordering, it's about the ordering of eigenvalues. We sometimes write it, if this was the eigenvalues of a density matrix, we would write it like this. We would say that rho majorizes sigma. And that's an important, that comes up again and again. There's a book called Majorization and Its Applications. It's about an 800-page book, and it comes up again and again. This is what gives you the criteria for entanglement state transformations. It's what gives you a criteria in thermodynamics. It's a stronger version of entropy. So this implies that the entropy of sigma is larger than the entropy of rho, but So it implies that, but it's a much stronger set of conditions. And you can see why this condition has to be satisfied, because I can only rob from the rich and give to the poor. So I first can, you know, the first condition tells me that I can move probability from here to here. Then the second condition tells me I can move from the two boxes to the three boxes. So this is a bit like, if we can think of, as a consequence of this, we get that the entropy of the final state has to be larger than the entropy of the initial state. That's just the ordinary second law of thermodynamics. But because we have D conditions for the dimension of our system, we have a lot more criteria, and we can think of this as having many second laws. So you can think of the second law of thermodynamics as saying, when can I go from an initial state to a final state? I can go if and only if the entropy of the target system is larger than the entropy of the initial system. And here what we find for we find a whole bunch of, we have D additional constraints here. And we can go from this configuration, this initial state, to this final state, if and only if rho majorizes sigma. Now, in the thermodynamic limit, if we were to have many of these boxes, then it turns out that all these conditions approximately just gives us the ordinary second law, namely that the entropy of the target state must be larger than the entropy of the initial state. How do you mean by local?
Well, you've got all these component pieces which whose entropies increase. You just described a large number of entropies that are increasing.
In the sense that if I look at this subspace, so for two systems, so if I have only two states, then of course there's only one criteria, right? Because majorization is equivalent to entropy increase for a system which has dimension two. Maybe this is what you're saying. And so if I want to look at each of these subspaces, then I can just think of it as entropy increase for this subspace, for all the different, if all the different two-dimensional subspaces, I can just...
I guess you're saying we don't only have local subspaces within collections.
Well, that's sure.
But also, how does this account for fluctuations, which can take you backwards? I'm confused about how that comes in.
What do you mean, fluctuations that take me backwards? You mean there's a chance that this one could flow this direction?
Yeah, if you open the partition, yeah.
Sure, but I'm just looking at the probabilities, right? So this probability is larger than this one. So sure, sometimes it was here and goes here, but what I care about is the probability, not the individual cases. Okay. So Alex asked about single-shot thermodynamics and kind of single-shot information theory. In some sense, majorization is behind almost, you know, a lot of the single-shot results. So at least classically, this implies most of the single shot results classically, just this majorization criteria. In the quantum case, there's a lot more structure, a lot more kind of criteria, and a lot more interesting things going on. But effectively, at least for the single, yeah, let me actually give some examples. So, and see how we get some single shot results. So let's imagine that we want to, remember we extracted KT log 2 bits of work previously when we knew what the molecule was. Let's imagine that we have, say, 5 possible partitions, and we want to extract work deterministically. In other words, you want to always succeed, or succeed with very high probability, from this system. We want to extract work, and let's imagine that the probability of it being in box number 3 and 4 and 5 is almost zero, so it's very small, some small epsilon, and we want to extract work from this system. What do we do? Anyone know? The best thing we can do? We want to succeed with almost probability almost 1.
take out the first two partitions and put a piston on the left?
You mean take out these two and put it on the...
I mean, you know the particle is going to be in the first three boxes.
Right. Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Right. So I would want to put the partition here. And then I know that, and then I open it up and it'll push it here. So I effectively am extracting work from the, if I want to extract work with certainty, I'm basically extracting it from the fact that I know that it's not in these two places. So the amount of work you can distill in some sense with, if I want to succeed with probability close to one, is going to be given by the dimension minus the rank. So log D minus the log of the rank of this distribution or the density matrix, right? And that's a result in, so I'm mentioning it because of it in single shot information theory. When people ask, I want to compress some state, you can, I mean, there's almost a trivial result. You just compress it to the rank is what tells you, the rank of the density matrix tells you if you want to succeed in compressing a state with almost certainty, that's what you have to do. So it means that, roughly speaking, you can very rarely extract work with certainty in this case. What you need is you need to have many copies of your state, and then in the thermodynamic limit, one finds that there's a whole bunch of partitions which are almost empty, right? So that's like if I have a coin which has probably two-thirds heads and one-third tail, then the rank of that is full, but if I flip the coin many times, then the probability of having all ones or all zeros is very small, and so those are like boxes which are unoccupied. So that's how, from this, in the thermodynamic limit, you are able to get the amount of work you can extract. It's just given by a difference of entropies. It's because when I go to the thermodynamic limit, all these unlikely events kind of pool together, right? Maybe I'll. Is it?
Okay.
Yeah. Good.
Where did KT come from? I mean, this was a particle that was just sitting in a box.
Right. So this is.
Suddenly there was a temperature.
Right. So sorry. I meant to begin. This is in a. We should picture this in a thermal bath. So this is in a thermal bath at temperature KT, log KT.
I thought there were just some rules for whether you could hop a particle to one box or the other.
The rule is just given by diffusion. So if I open up a partition, it will just diffuse in some way. So think of it like a box just sitting in a thermal bath.
So what happened to the Robin Hood?
So the Robin Hood was just about getting from, if I want to go from some density matrix rho to some density matrix sigma. So I just want to know when can I go from some initial state to some final state, then I can only go by the, I can only go if rho majorizes sigma, and that's being given by these Robin Hood processes. But the Robin Hood processes are happening because this thing is just sitting in a bath and this molecule is bouncing around because it's sitting in a bath with temperature KT. I feel like I'm not satisfying you, and once again, Wojtek is looking like he might want to say something.
Well, I'm just really confused as to what the starting point is. I mean, I would like to say a starting point. I'm going to use quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. Here are my degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. Here's the Hamiltonian.
Right.
Here's the initial state.
Okay.
Or classical mechanics.
Right.
Or some cellular automaton.
Sure.
Has some set of rules.
Sure.
And I'm just not getting what the starting point is.
Fair enough. I maybe have been a bit sloppy in that I wanted to present a very toy, a toy model for thermodynamics, which I hoped would make things simple for and kind of get the and show the main features of what I want to talk about. And I will let me get to that and kind of be more explicit about the rules of the game. So I think you're right, and I think one of the things that information theory and resource theories give you is what you want to do is specify very precisely the rules of the game. What do we mean by thermodynamics? And from there you can derive the necessary and sufficient conditions, for example, for state transformations. So you're right in that. I was just hoping to present a kind of intuitive toy theory. Good. All right, so here we see that we get this kind of single shot work in the sense that if we have a single system, we can extract, if we want to succeed with certainty, we can only extract kt log d minus the log of the rank amount of work from the system.
What's the rank for that?
It would be 3, right? So this is log 5 minus log 3.
Okay, and that doesn't depend on the fact that the log is different.
Right, so you kind of lose that thing. Now, and likewise, if we want to do the opposite process, so say we started with a, let's imagine that we have a molecule which is initially initially uniform. So let's have two boxes here, two partitions, and now imagine that the probability is 1/2 and 1/2. So this is in some sense an equilibrium, and now we want to create a probability distribution where the probability here is 2/3 and the probability here is 1/3. How do we do that? What's the amount of work required to do that? And it's given by the largest probability. So the amount, so this is like the distillable work and the work of formation, the amount of work required to go from the uniform state, you know, the thermal equilibrium state in some sense, to a state we're interested in, is given by kT times the log of the largest probability. And this is also these are your two extreme situations. And the way you would do that is you would start from here, you would push in your partition up to around here. So you would take out this central partition, you would apply work until the molecule was somewhere in one of these three imaginary partitions, and then you would put in this central partition, you would actually put it in here and remove the piston, and then you would have created a distribution where the probability of it being in the left partition was 2/3 and the probability of it being in the right partition was 1/3. And you've done that by putting in an amount of work which is given by the kT log times the largest probability. So you see here you have two extreme, when you just are dealing with a single system, you have two extreme cases. When you want to extract work from a probability distribution, you the amount of work you can extract depends on the rank of the density matrix you want to do with certainty. On the other hand, when we want to do the opposite process, create a probability distribution, the amount of work is given by the largest eigenvalue. Those things are very different. But if we were to go to the thermodynamic limit, those two things become equal, approximately. And the reason is as follows. When we are flipping coins, let's imagine we're flipping coins which have a probably 2/3 of being heads and a probably 1/3 of being tails. If we keep flipping the coin many times, then after we have done that many times, the probability, then almost all the states have, this is called the law of large numbers, almost all the states have 2/3 heads and 1/3 tails. And the probability that you deviate from that is very small. So you have almost uniform probability that you have a state with 2/3 heads, 1/3 tails. And the probability that you are far are away from that distribution is very small. I could write down the, yeah.
This is a stupid question, but if I want to start from a uniform distribution and I want to obtain like a delta, like this is exactly what you would call an erasure.
That's right.
But you said it was kT log 2. To have to do an erasure, right?
Sorry?
You said the amount of work needed to do an erasure is kT log 2.
Yes.
But now if I put like Pmax equal to 1,
you get infinity. Right. So this is the fluctuation thing. So this is where you kind of have to succeed with probability 1.
Oh.
So if you allow some fluctuations, then you get things a bit nicer. I guess it depends what convention you want to write. So sometimes you could say that the amount of work that is required is positive and the amount you get out is negative, or whichever way you want to think about it. Yeah, maybe I do. That's just, yeah. I think so, yeah. I think that's right. Thanks, Nicole. Okay, so that was just the toy model, and now we'll get into the kind of more general resource theory. And as Mark said, let's try and be more precise about what we mean by thermodynamics. Okay. So let me be very general and start off by talking about resource theories and why it's useful. And so what I'll say here is not going to pertain to thermodynamics, but will apply to all resource theories. And what we imagine, what we can talk about resource theories in the following way. We have, and I apologize that I'm repeating myself for those who were here for the entanglement tutorial, but we imagine that we have a class of operations. Let's call that C. All right. And then let's imagine that that class of operations, so it's a restriction on what we're allowed to do. So in entanglement theory, remember it was local operations and classical communication was the class of operations. Here, we'll define thermodynamics by a restriction on what the experimenter is allowed to do. And and with a class of operations, we end up having a set S, which we'll call the fixed set, and those are the set of states which if we are given one from this, if we're given an element from the set, we cannot move out of the set. So, for example, in local operations and classical communication and entanglement theory, this fixed set or this free set is given by the separable state. So, if we're given a separable state, then we cannot create an entangled state under the class of operations of local operations and classical communication. So here's the set of all states, and then we have this set S inside here, and the class of operations keeps us in this set. That's the structure of our theory, or what we mean by a resource theory. An example is thermodynamics. So Mark, here's one definition of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is the class of all operations for which, if you start in the thermal state, you cannot get out of the thermal state. That's a definition. There's other ones.
Thermal state.
Sorry?
What is a thermal state?
So here we are, it's just going to be, for any Hamiltonian, so I give you some Hamiltonian and I fix the temperature. So I have a resource theory given the temperature. So I say, you're allowed, in your resource theory, you're allowed to give me any thermal state with any Hamiltonian, and my class of operations has to keep me in that state.
So
I'm just defining it by the free state.
This is a density matrix of the quantum system.
That's right.
And I'm allowed to pick H sub S arbitrarily?
You can pick H sub S arbitrarily.
And S consists of some subset of the degrees of freedom of the whole system?
You can pick, I guess you're allowed to pick any, so for these free states, I'll let you pick any systems you want, any Hamiltonians you want.
Okay, but we have to start somewhere. So can we start with, say, N qubits?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we have N qubits.
Yeah.
And they don't have an intrinsic Hamiltonian that we're
running. No, you're allowed to pick your Hamiltonian. Okay. So the rules of the game are, the rules of the game will be like this. I will give you some system, let's call it rho S, which you may be interested in, and you are allowed to pick as many thermal states as you want, made out of qubits if you want, but I could allow you anything.
When you say a system, I mean, Can we declare the system to be n qubits?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So we have n qubits.
That's right.
And there's no intrinsic Hamiltonian that's governing their dynamics. We just have them sitting there in the
lab. Well, let me
do whatever you want.
Okay, let me distinguish between the system and the things that as the experimenter are allowed to bring into the game.
Okay.
So let's have our system be rho s. It's in some density matrix, and it's qubits.
This language is confusing. I want to say the system is n qubits.
I'm a fan of it.
You're putting a density matrix on this system.
That's right.
That's not the system. The system.
Okay, it's a system. You're right.
N qubit.
That's right.
Rho is a density matrix, which is a mixed state of the system.
That's right.
Okay, so I'm allowed to pick any rho I want?
No.
Okay.
Now you are allowed, as an experimenter, to bring in as many thermal states, systems in the thermal state, as you want. So you are allowed to pick any Hamiltonian you want, bring a thermal state.
What does bring a thermal state mean?
You are allowed to add in, so you're allowed to take, let's call it beta here. So you're allowed, you can imagine you have an apparatus and you're allowed to kind of wheel it over to the n qubits.
Okay, so I have a system outside the n qubits.
Right.
That I'm allowed to, and what does this system consist of?
Whatever you want, but you can take it to be qubits if you would like.
N qubit.
Sure, let's take it to be n qubits.
So I have one system s of n qubits and another system beta of n qubits.
That's right.
Okay.
And the one definition, there's another one I prefer called thermal operations, but I will, just for simplicity, start with this one. One set of rules of the game, in other words, the class of operations that I'm allowed, is that I'm allowed to perform any operation which, if the input is the thermal state, the output will also be the thermal state.
Okay. And thermal state, again, means?
This.
And this is H within subsystem, I'm going to call it a subsystem now because I'm going to think of the whole thing as the system.
Right. Let's do it like this. So it could be
out of the n qubits in subsystem S, or I'm allowed to use.
So if I call one the system and one the reservoir, then I need to, if both the system and the reservoir were in the thermal state, then it would have to preserve this.
Is rho beta the same as rho r?
Is rho beta? Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, that's right. Well, the Hamiltonian, indeed.
Is the extra system reservoir?
That's right, yeah.
At temperature, beta also presumably.
That's right.
An extra assumption is that M in your language is much, much bigger than M.
No, I don't need to make that assumption, no.
Okay.
No, that's the whole point. We want to not take thermodynamic limits in these things.
Okay, so I have an N qubit system over here, and I have an m qubit system over here,
right.
And we're going to put it in a quantum state, which is a product state of a state of a mixed state of the n qubit system,
right.
And a mixed state of the m qubit system,
right.
And they're both of the form e to the minus beta h sum.
No, I haven't said that. What I said is that your class of operations. So I'm now just defining the class of operations. The class of operations is such that if the input was this, then the output would be this. So in other words, the class of operations are such that it takes thermal states to thermal states.
Okay, but when I'm confused by the word states instead of the word state. This looks like a single state to me.
It's an equivalence class because it's equivalent classes at a particular. So what's important is the beta.
Okay.
And I don't care about the Hamiltonian. So.
Okay, so when you say a state of this form, you mean for an arbitrary.
That's right. That's right.
And H sub S can be anything at all, any operator at all on the Hermitian operator on the n qubit system, no matter how complicated.
That's right.
And H sub R can be any operator at all, Hermitian operator at all, no matter how complicated on the m qubit system.
That's right.
But I'm not allowed to put up there something that has a qubit from the n qubits and another qubit from the m qubits.
Why aren't you allowed to say what you mean by?
You've written H sub S plus H sub R.
Oh, I see. For example, unitaries are allowed in this. So I could, for example, do a unitary.
I just wanted to define the class of states before we start.
Right.
So in the class of states that I'm defining.
I think we're, there's
you're defining.
Right. I think I want to distinguish between two things. One is the class of operations itself.
Okay.
In which case, I don't need to write anything. I could just keep this any Hamiltonian. It doesn't really matter whether I have an interaction term or not. I just want to say that regardless of the Hamiltonian that you put here, it needs to keep a thermal state, a thermal state. It needs to map a thermal state to a thermal state.
I just want to know what the states are before.
I want to first define the allowable operations.
The states are anything.
Right. So I want to define the class of operations.
Some class of states that are the free states that you can add in as part of his set of allowable operations.
Okay.
Well, in other words, think of it like entanglement theory. So in entanglement theory, you have a class of operations. For example, it could be the operations which preserve separable states. And that's how I just define what Alice and Bob are allowed to do. And that's it. And then I will start talking about what states they're actually going to start acting on. But I first want to just define the class of operations and the set of free states. So the set of free states, I'm just saying, are any thermal state with any Hamiltonian. But the important thing is that it's an equivalence class with temperature beta, inverse temperature beta.
But I just don't see how this restricts this set of states at all. You give me an arbitrary density matrix, I take its logarithm, and I declare that to be the Hamiltonian.
Right, it doesn't at all, it doesn't at all restrict it. But it restricts the...
But the point is, you can't change the Hamiltonian in the middle of doing the operation. So you're given a thermal state for this particular Hamiltonian, and then you do the operation, and it still has to be a thermal state for that same Hamiltonian.
That's right.
But there's only one thermal state for that Hamiltonian if we keep the temperature fixed.
Yeah, but there's many different possible Hamiltonians.
But you said we can't change the Hamiltonian.
No, but you can bring in... So the experimenter is an ingenious person who she can bring whatever she wants to the game, and she can bring in some apparatus, she can bring in a heat bath, and she should be allowed to couple it to any heat bath she wants. So the important thing is, so we just care that it's an inverse temperature beta, but we don't care what the particulars of that thermal state is. So it could be with any Hamiltonian, but the important part is that if she were, so say she brings in her favorite, let's imagine she were to bring in her favorite Hamiltonian for her reservoir, and she's going to couple it to some system, which let's just imagine that for the moment that the total Hamiltonian is going to be HS plus HR. Let's just take that for the moment. And the important thing is that if the system was initially in a thermal state, then her action on the reservoir and the system has to leave a thermal state a thermal state. And she's allowed to pick any...
Going in circles, but I just still don't understand, if she's allowed to change the Hamiltonian, what the definition of a thermal state...
Maybe I try. So imagine that you have the system, it's in some box, and you have a room at some temperature T. And in the room you have metals, you have some bucket of water, but it's all temperature T. So each thing that you have in the room has the same temperature, but it has a different Hamiltonian defining how the degrees of freedom interact and what energy corresponds to these different states. But the experimenter can bring that and put it next to the system and then do something, which...
I don't understand what do something.
So why don't
interact
you,
with
you,
it.
Why don't you give examples of how operations are?
Right, so, okay. Maybe that will help. All right, so let me give an example of operations which preserve the Gibbs state. This is in fact, I'll call this thermal operations. It's a smaller class of operations than this theory here that I was describing, but it's an example of a class of operations which preserve the Gibbs state. So I'm allowed to do any unitary that commutes with the total Hamiltonian. Okay. So I'm allowed to do this. I'm allowed to do any unitary which commutes with the reservoir system and something we're going to call a catalyst. I'm allowed to bring in any ancilla called a catalyst, as long as that the final state So whatever I do on this catalyst, it stays the same. So this is any cyclic process on a catalyst. In other words, the experimenter is allowed to bring in some apparatus, a working body, a piston, all kinds of other stuff, a work system, etc. And they're allowed to bring it in and allowed to do whatever they want, allowed to do some operation which will involve it, as long as it's a cyclic process, meaning it's returned back to its original state. Okay. So, and what we're going to demand is total energy conservation. And this might look...
Is part of you?
Or sorry?
Lambda, you have lambda and you have u, and I don't know the relation between...
Right, lambda is going to be the total class of operations. So I'm defining it, I'm allowed to do a unitary, which commutes with the total Hamiltonian. I'm allowed to trace out, throw away any system. So it includes unitaries and tracing out. So let's do like 1, 2, and that makes up lambda.
But I'm not allowed to trace out the catalyst because I have to have it at the end.
That's right. And also I'm allowed to bring in any thermal state with any Hamiltonian as long as it's at a particular temperature given by inverse beta. So I'm allowed to bring in these states where bringing in means doing this, putting it in a tensor product.
So, I mean, but the... Any unitary that you do has to commute with that Hamiltonian as well.
Right.
Or some of that Hamiltonian.
That's right.
So the set of operations, set of unitaries that you can do depends on what systems you bring in.
That's right. But this is just saying, this is just energy conservation. So. So it's like saying, one way of saying it is, if you do change the Hamiltonian, which you're allowed to do in this situation, you need to account for the ancilla that changes the Hamiltonian. So often we think of changing the Hamiltonian from the outside. In this case, we're putting the mechanism inside. So this would be, so in the case where people often consider changing the Hamiltonian, that would be needed to be put into the working body, the machine. In other words, what we want, this looks frightening, it looks like it's very restrictive, but all it's saying is that in thermodynamics we care about entropy, we care about information, we also care about energy. We want to ensure that energy is conserved. And the reason we want to ensure that energy is conserved is because we want to know how much energy was required to perform a particular task, and so we need to make sure that we account for all sources of energy. Now what people, another way of doing it, which is classically equivalent, is to just say we are going to change the Hamiltonian and then we're going to measure the energy initially and finally, and the missing energy we're going to call work. That's the same thing. But here we just want to make sure that it's just a different way of accounting. So we could either impose this, what appears to be a very strong condition, and say that you have to conserve energy, but you could also say, I'm not going to worry about energy conservation, and I'm just going to call any missing energy, I'm just going to call that work. That's another way of doing it. And that's what people often do in the fluctuation theory community. These things are equivalent. So this is an example of a class of operations. If you look at it, the energy is conserved, and you're allowed to bring in the thermal state. And what you will find is that if the input to this class of operations is a thermal state, it will stay a thermal state. Does that make things clear at all?
But look, you say what am I allowed to trace out? The reservoir?
Anything you want. So what I'm interested in is I start off with some system in state rho s. I go to some fine, I act a thermal operation on it, I get some final state, and I want to know when can I do this. And so what this might include is coupling to a thermal reservoir, doing a whole bunch of stuff, and then I'm not interested in the state of the reservoir at the end of the day, so I should trace it out and see if I can get this state.
Okay. And rho prime sub S prime is allowed to be, so is rho of S e to the minus beta HS for some?
No, this could be any state. So now, so I'm defining, this is why I wanted to separate out the definition of the class of operations from what the systems and the state that I'm going to act it on. Because what I want to do is I want to say the class of operations preserves the thermal state. And now I'm interested in what happens if I act it on some other state. And what other, and what target states can I get? So, I could define my class of operations at least, in terms of the set of states which are left invariant under the class of operations. And now I'm interested in a particular state which is outside of that class, which is not the thermal state. So some rho s, and I want to know, can I go to some target state rho s prime? Okay. That's the question. And that's, I like to think of this as a question about asking what are the second laws of this, in this resource theory. Because the second law tells us we can only go from one state to another if the free energy decreases, or depending on what's, or the entropy increases. And here, I also want a set of conditions which tell me whether I can make this transition or not. And of course, since this is fairly general, I could ask it about any resource theory. What I really need to know is what is the set of states which are kept fixed under the class of operations. So for thermodynamics, it happens to be the Gibbs state. But for other operations, it will be something else. So people have studied. Yesterday, we heard about magic state distillation for quantum computation. There is a resource theory of magic, which deals with the resource theory of magic states and trying to distill magic states in order to do an efficient computation. So you can, this is quite a useful tool for, which you can use in many circumstances. Which is why I kind of wanted to, so a takeaway message is that even if you don't care about thermodynamics, you can use these tools in other areas of physics. Yes?
It's also clear that I can go from any free state to any free state with this.
That's right.
Because like I can just throw it away and create a new one. But like they are in the same.
Yes, that's true. Okay. So now we're interested in these second laws, and it is a, and so we call these what we're interested in are things which are functions which are monotones under the class of operations, meaning, so for an example. Is the relative entropy distance to this set is a monotone. In particular, the relative entropy distance to the thermal state is just the free energy, or is the free energy of my state minus the free energy of the Gibbs state. So you can think of the free energy as being a distance, giving a distance to the thermal state. And what we will find is that the distance to the thermal state has to go down. So thermodynamics, and what happens in thermodynamics is you just always get closer to the thermal state. That's what's happening. If you want to move further away, you have to add work. And one of the things is there are many different measures of distance to the thermal state, and those all give you constraints on what you're allowed to do. So that also happened in this little toy theory. So you could think of this little toy theory as the case where the temperature is infinite, so where the thermal state is just the maximally mixed state, and majorization is a distance to telling you how close you are to being maximally mixed. Right. So let me just give a generic monotone. So a generic monotone is that I take, so let's call it d of rho s, and it's just equal to we'll pick any distance measure. So let's take we take a distance measure of our state. And we take it to a free state, which is closest to it in distance. Right. So here's a distance measure, and so what we want to the distance measure is measuring how close our state is, rho s, to another state, and what we want to do is pick from our free set a state for which minimizes this distance. And this here is a monotone under the class of operations, meaning it can only go down. And it's a good monotone as long as we pick a distance measure which is contractive. We say it's contractive under CPTP map. So if we have, I use a notation here which is just lambda. Let me specify that this is lambda of the class of operations. So let's call it lambda sub C. A good distance measure is one which is contractive, meaning that if I act any completely positive trace preserving map on my state, then this quantity goes down. Okay, you can see that this is a good way of thinking about distances of states, because you can imagine trying to distinguish two states, rho and sigma, and of course any good measure of distinguishability, the distinguishability goes down if someone comes along and performs some action on the two states, right? Because anything you do to the state will disturb it and make it harder to distinguish. So that's why most distance measures, or any good distance measure, will be contractive. It will go down under acting a completely positive trace preserving map on the state. So an example is the relative entropy distance. Call it, and that is just equal to trace of rho log rho minus trace of rho log sigma. You can verify that if I look at the relative entropy distance of my state to the thermal state, that just is the free energy of my state minus the free energy of the thermal state. Okay, so the relative entropy distance is just free energy. Likewise, there's a whole bunch of things called Renyi divergences. Trace of rho to the alpha, sigma to the 1 minus alpha, sorry, the log of this thing. We saw this quantity actually yesterday in Aitor's talk about where people are trying to compute dualities between ADS and CFT, so these quantities kind of come up in a number of places as well. And it's a distance measure between two states. It's related to majorization. It's related to majorization in the case where you are allowed some machine, some catalyst. And so it turns out that these quantities, at least for states which are diagonal in an energy eigenbasis, these states, these quantities give necessary and sufficient conditions for when I can go from some initial state to some final state. Okay. So I mentioned in this little toy theory, in the case where the Hamiltonian is trivial or I'm at infinite temperature, majorization tells me whether I can go from one state to another. In the more general case of this kind of thermodynamics, it's the Renyi divergences which tell me whether I can go from one state to another. Okay, so the Renyi divergences play the role of majorization in some sense. I feel like I went through things a bit too quickly there, for maybe a third of you, and not quickly enough for the rest of you.
Sorry? That's the equation, so we think that there are no questions.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm just giving quantity. So I guess the main message is there are any, if I give you any distance measure to the set of free states, then that is a monotone which tells me whether I can go from one state to another. It gives you a second law, and there are many of them, and so we have these many criteria which tells us whether we can go from one state to another. Here they're distances to Gibbs states, to the thermal state. In a general resource theory, they would just be the distance measure to the set of free states. So this is kind of a generic way of having criteria which tell me whether I can go from some initial state to some final state.
Do these distance measures restrict the things I can do?
No, so the thing that restricts what I can do is just defining what happens when I define the class of operations. What these distance measures tell me is, given this restriction on what you can do, the class of operations, they tell you, they answer the question, can I go from this state to this state?
But if I said, I really want to go from that state to that state, and I've just picked them, is there some notion of whether I can or cannot find a distance measure that will allow me to do that?
Well, you can always. Finding a distance measure is not is pretty easy. So, as I mentioned, I could just take the Renyi divergence. I just need any contractive distance. So, the Renyi divergences are good ones, for example.
The distance measures don't allow you to do transformations. They prevent you from doing transformations.
Well, right. So, I want to know. Suppose I really want to do a transformation, but your distance measure prevents me from doing it. Can I find another distance measure that will allow me to do it?
No, all distance measures. So, right, that's the thing. Look, I'm not doing so well. So you.
It has to be reduced under all distance measures, all possible monotones.
Okay. So yeah. So any distance measure I get will give me a set of necessary conditions. You might then ask, what are the distance measures which also give me sufficient conditions? And that is a much harder question. Generally.
Yeah. What, from the thermodynamic perspective, what's special about the relative entropy with respect to the other distance measures?
So it's the one that it has a special role in two ways, at least. One is that if I were to take the thermodynamic limit, it would be all the other ones would converge to it, at least if I made approximations. So often I don't care. So first of all, you often want approximations. So you ask the question, if I have two states and I'm going to some target state rho prime, I may only care. I may be happy if I can get very close to the state. So you want to pick a distance measure, or you want to allow approximation. So you should say, I want that my distance measure, I need that my distance measure goes down in going to rho prime, but I'm also happy if it goes down in going to some other state, rho prime epsilon, which is epsilon close to my target state. I might be just happy with that. So if I just require this, then it turns out that in the thermodynamic limit, what I get is that all distance measures become equal to the relative entropy. Sorry?
You mean functions.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, So I don't care. So these things, of course, are only defined up to a multiplicative and an additive constant. So if I then normalize them, if they're extensive and I normalize them onto a particular state, then they become equal for all. Then they're all equal. Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so I will just, I guess I should end. And then let me just mention fluctuations rather than go into them in too much detail. It turns out there's a whole I'll say what the fluctuations relations are. So let me just say that, so we have these many these criteria which tells whether we can go from one state to another. And it turns out that these criteria imply something called the Jarzynskis and the Crook relation. So they imply all these. Good. Jarzynski. Jarzynski. Okay. I should know better. Jarzynski. So these imply the Jarzynski relation and the Crookes relation, which are various fluctuation relations. So what do we mean by that? So in thermodynamics, we're usually interested in average quantities, right? We want to know one way of giving the ordinary second law is to say that the average work has to be less than the change in free energy between my initial state and some final state. So I have an initial state with some free energy, a final state with a different free energy, and the amount of work that I can get from this, that I can extract during this transition, has to be less than the change in free energy. That is one way of saying what the second law of thermodynamics is, right? And the same thing happens in entanglement theory. You know, the amount of entanglement we can extract in a pure state transformation is given by the change in local entropy of the state. The fluctuation relations are equality. So this is an inequality to do with average values, but I can think of the work as a random variable, and the Jarzynski equation is an equality. It's very beautiful. It's an equality which says that the expectation value of the work, understood as a random value, random variable, is given by, there's a beta here. That's right. There's an equality between the expectation value of the exponential of the work fluctuations, and if you were to expand this to first order, you would get the ordinary second law, but then you get higher order corrections to it, right? And so what it turns out is that this is actually implied by majorization. So what we've been able to show is that this just is given by so majorization implies this. So this is, you can think of it as one law which is an average value law. The majorization conditions give you D conditions, and they, when you average them, you actually just get the Jarzynski equation. I think to get into that, I'd have to talk about work fluctuations and how you talk about work in these models, that would take more than 15 minutes. So. I'll leave that, but I guess it's a nice, maybe a take-home message from this thing is that in thermodynamics we see that we have these many criteria, these many second laws. They imply the fluctuation relations. It turns out that in entanglement theory, we knew we had these majorization criteria, these many conditions. It turns out that also implies a fluctuation relation for entanglement theory. So you can write a fluctuation relation for entanglement theory which looks very similar to the Jarzynski equation. I'm massacring it again. And that is a general relation which seems to apply in many resource theories. So in other words, if you have a majorization relation, then you will... It looks as if, we don't have a general proof of it, but we have two examples where it then implies a fluctuation relation. So this kind of brings into the fold fluctuation relations, which are found in thermodynamics, into the resource theory picture. So there seems to be, majorization is ubiquitous. We see it in many different areas of physics and economics and various branches of mathematics. And so it's a bit exciting in that it suggests that when we have majorization relations, we also have fluctuation relations, and possibly vice versa. So there's, I think, kind of a whole bunch of things that are worthwhile studying here. And with that, I'll just thank you for your attention.
theory? What is this fluctuation relation relate?
So I imagine I want to have a pure state transformation. So I want to go from some state to some other pure state between Alice and Bob. We know from Nielsen's theorem that whether we can do it or not is given by the majorization criteria. Now, if we have, if this was likewise in thermodynamics, you want to go from some state to some other state. This may require work, so you can ask how much work we require to get from one state to the other. Likewise, in entanglement theory, you could imagine that you allow for some entanglement to help you make the state transformation. So you might have some entanglement, and this amount of entanglement could fluctuate. So for example, we introduced something called an entanglement battery, and in the entanglement battery, you have some amount of entanglement, and you do the transformation, and the entanglement battery is raised or lowered after that process. And now, in the work fluctuations, what you do is you do this process many times and you look at how much work you used each time, because it's a fluctuating thing, and then you find that it satisfies the fluctuation theorem. Likewise here, you have this entanglement battery, you do your transformation, your pure state entanglement transformation, you look how much entanglement you used each time, and you find that it satisfies this fluctuation theorem. So it plays a very similar role.
What's beta in that case?
Beta is just one, so there's no beta. There's no beta there. The free energy is the dimension. Yeah. You also get a Crookes relation, so things become reversible. So you can now do single copy transformations on your states. So usually you had to go to the many copy limit to have a reversible theory. Here you can just have. You can do single copy transformations, it becomes perfectly reversible, and you can do any, you can always do it.